Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Jayo Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Jaya Gopijana Vallabha Girivara Thari. Jaya Gopijana Vallabha Girivara Thari. Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana. Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana. Yamuna Tira Vanakari. Yamuna Tira Vanakari. Jayo Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Jayo Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Jaya Gopijana Vallabha Girivara Thari. Jaya Gopijana Vallabha Girivara Thari. Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana. Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana. Yamuna Tira Vanakari. Yamuna Tira Vanakari. Jayo Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Jayo Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Jai Om Vishnupada Paramahansa Parivrajika Acharya Ishto Tarashto Shri Shimareshi Bhakti Vedanta Swami Prabhupada Ki Jai Parantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai Nitai Gaur Paimanande Hari Hari Bo Samabita Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai Agarish the Assembly of Verti, Agarish the Assembly of Verti, Agarish the Assembly of Verti, Agarish the Shri Shri Guru Gauranga. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 54, The Marriage of Krishna and Rukmini, text number 41 through 44. We'll do 41 responsibly. Word meanings, Rajasya, of kingdom, Bhume, of land, Vittasya, of wealth, Striyaha, of a woman, Manasya, of honor, Tejasaha, of power, Maninaha, those who are proud, Anyasya, of something else, Va, or Hetaho, for the reason, Shri, in their opulence, Mada, by their intoxication, Andaha, blinded, Kshipanti, they commit insult, he indeed. Rajasya Bhumir Vittasya Striyo Manasya Tejasa Manino Nyasya Vahito Srimadandha Kripantihi Rajasya Bhumir Vittasya Striyo Manasya Tejasa Manino Nyasya Vahito Srimadanda Kripantihi Rajasya Bhumir Vittasya Striyo Manasya Tejasa Manino Nyasya Vahito Srimadandha Kshipantihi Rajasya Bhumir Vittasya Sriyo Manasya Tejasa Manino Ladies. Translation. Again, Balaram addressed Krishna. Blinded by conceit with their personal opulences, proud men offend others for the sake of such things as kingdom, land, wealth, women, honor, and power. Purport. Lord Krishna was originally meant to marry Rukmini. All along, this was the best arrangement for all concerned. And yet, from the beginning, Rukmi had maliciously opposed this beautiful arrangement. When his sister's desire was finally fulfilled and she was taken by Krishna, he viciously attacked the Lord with vulgar insults and mortal weapons. In return, Lord Krishna tied him up and partially clipped his hair and mustache. While certainly humiliating for a puffed-up prince like Rukmi, his punishment was a mere slap on the wrist, considering what he had done. So we have three more verses. We can chant them together. Taveyam vishama buddhi sarva bhuteshu dhurdham yamam se sada bhadram suridham bhadram agyavat. To Rukmini, Balaram said, "Your attitude is unfair, for like an ignorant person, you wish good to those who are inimical to all living beings and who have done evil to your true well-wishers." Atma moho nrinam eva kalpate deva mayaya surid udasina iti dehatma maninam. The Supreme Lord's maya makes men forget their real selves, and thus, taking the body for the self, they consider others to be friends, enemies, or neutral parties. Eka eva parohyatma sarvesham api dehinam naneva grihyate murher yatha jyotir yatha nabaha. Those who are bewildered perceive the one supreme soul who resides in all embodied beings as many, just as one may perceive the light in the sky or the sky itself as many. Purport. The last line of this text, yatha jyotir yatha nabaha, introduces two analogies in which we perceive one thing to be many. Jyoti indicates the light of heavenly bodies such as the sun or moon. Although there is only one moon, we may see the moon reflected in pools, rivers, lakes, and buckets of water. Then it would appear as if there were many moons, although there is only one. Similarly, we perceive a divine presence in each living being because the Supreme Lord is present everywhere, although he is one. The second analogy given here, yatha nabaha, is that of the sky. If we have a row of sealed clay pots in a room, the sky or air is in each pot, although the sky itself is one. The Srimad Bhagavatam 1.2.32 gives a similar analogy concerning fire and wood. Yata yavahito vanir darushweka swayonishu naneva bhati vishvatma bhuteshu chatata puman. The Lord, as the Supersoul, pervades all things, just as fire permeates wood, and so he appears to be of many varieties, although he is the absolute one without a second. Om jnana timirandhasya jnananjana shalakaya chakshurin miritam yena tasmai shri gurave namaha shri prabhupada ki jaya. This is an interesting little interlude here. We had some action scenes, fighting going on. Now Balaram is doing some preaching. It's interesting to see this side of Balaram. He's taking the role of the big brother here. And there's a little bit of a disagreement between Rukmini and Krishna. So he's instructing on both sides, going back and forth, giving them all good, both of them good instructions. The essence of the instructions is, this is what people are like when they're in Maya, and you shouldn't be like this. And he points out different characteristics of people who are in Maya. In other words, Krishna and Rukmini, they're highly cultured persons, meant to be following Dharma, meant to be displaying qualities of goodness, doing the right thing. But right now they're expressing actions or concerns that seem to be symptomatic of people who don't really know the absolute truth. So Balaram is explaining what is reality. And here first he's talking to Krishna. He's telling Krishna, the first verse we read, blinded by conceit with their personal opulences, Proud men offend others for the sake of such things as kingdom, land, wealth, women, honor, and power. In other words, don't be like these other men who have these characteristics. When we look at this list, they really seem to be characteristics of Kshatriyas especially. They're blind, they're proud. They're conceited, they're proud, and they offend others for such things as kingdom, land, wealth, women, honor, and power. So these are all the things that the Kshatriyas especially aspire for. And they're proud. Pride is such a... Actually, when we look at this quality, especially pride and conceit, not very attractive. Maybe today, some people think it's attractive. There's so many proud people. But for a devotee, we know that pride is not a good thing. Krishna talks about it in Bhagavad Gita in several places. For example, in the 15th chapter, Krishna talks about, this chapter is called Yoga of the Supreme Person. So in the beginning, Krishna talks about how one can go back home, back to Godhead. One verse, the fifth verse of the 15th chapter, Nirmano Moha Jitta Sangha Dosha Adhyatma Nitya Vinivritta Kama Dvandver Vimukta Sukha Dukha Sangyer Kachantya Mudha Paramavyam Tat. So it gives a list of different qualities we have to have if we want to Padam Avyayam Tat Gachanti. We want to attain that transcendental abode, Krishna's abode. So the list begins with Nirmana. That means without mana. So mana is the word in this verse today. Manasya Striyo Manasya Tejasaha. So they're proud. So one has to be without pride to go back home, back to Godhead. You see this often. I often think about how hard it is to get one person to become a devotee. Mm-hmm. We contact thousands, maybe millions of people. Like Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, out of thousands, hardly one is interested. So devotees are contacting so many people every day. And to just get a little interest is something. We get encouraged by it. But to get one person to actually become a devotee, it's really... Prabhupada said we have to be prepared to sacrifice gallons of blood just to make one devotee. So that's what it takes, doesn't it? So, and why is that? Well, one of the main reasons is pride. People are proud. In this purport, Prabhupada talks about pride. Pretty much about half of the purport, even though there's a whole list of different things, about half of the purport is about pride. Let me read some of this. The surrendering process is described here very nicely. The first qualification is that one should not be deluded by pride. Because the conditioned soul is puffed up, thinking himself the lord of material nature, it is very difficult for him to surrender unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead. One should know by the cultivation of real knowledge that he is not lord of material nature. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is the Lord. When one is free from delusion caused by pride, he can begin the process of surrender. For one who is always expecting some honor in this material world, it is not possible to surrender to the Supreme Person. Pride is due to illusion. For although one comes here, stays for a brief time, and then goes away, he has the false notion that he is the Lord of the world. He thus makes all things complicated, and he is always in trouble. I like that line. The whole world moves under this impression. People are considering the land, this earth, to belong to human society, and they have divided the land under the false impression that they are the proprietors. One has to get out of this false notion that human society is the proprietor of the world. So not only am I not the proprietor, human society is not even the proprietor in general. And because Prabhupada often uses the phrase false pride. What does it mean, false pride? In one place, Prabhupada explains that it's false pride because there's no basis for it, That's why it's false. You're proud of whatever you have, but it doesn't belong to you. You haven't created anything. You don't have anything. Whatever you have is not of your own doing. It's coming from outside. Just like intelligence, we have the experience. You try to remember something, can't remember it, and then it comes to you. Well, how? How did it come? You didn't make it happen. Somebody else sent it. Actually, in the second canto, this is given as evidence for the super soul. There's somebody else, some other source of knowledge or source of inspiration. And Sariputta Prabhu wrote different articles on inspiration, how people, a lot of times, inspiration for great breakthroughs in scientific advancements and so on, they just come out of the blue. We may have this idea that, just like some mathematician, for example, is plodding away step by step, trying to solve some very technical mathematical problem, some challenge. So every day he's going in there and spending hours and hours and trying this and trying that. And then one morning he wakes up and he has a solution and has nothing to do with what he's been, the steps that he's been taking. It comes from a completely different place. So it wasn't his plodding along step by step mechanically that brought the solution. It was Krishna, it was Super Soul who sent it. So we can't be proud because even our own intelligence or anything else we do, we're so dependent on everything. So that's the idea behind false pride. We really have nothing to be proud of. And I like the way Prabhupada characterizes it here. Because we come and we're actually in a false position. We don't own this place. We can't control it. It's not ours. So therefore, we're always in trouble. It's like if you go in to solve some problem, and you'd have no idea what you're doing. Then you're just in trouble, which is happens what politicians tend to do, of course. They campaign how they're going to solve all the problems, and they just go in and make things worse. Because they're out of their element. So solving the problems of life, we're all out of our element. Because Krishna has the solution. The Vedic scriptures have the solution. I happen to be working on doing some editing for the Sundarbhas, so I get to read a lot of Gopi Puranadhan Prabhu, his writing, and I've also listened to a lot of his lectures. And this is something he really harps on, how the Vedas are eternal transcendental knowledge. They're not man-made. They're perfect. The Vedas exist eternally, and great sages in the past, they're able to read them. I think today they have in the paranormal world, people talk about reading the Akashic records or something. There's this whole idea that somewhere written up there in the ether, there's different things, and there are certain adepts who can perceive and read those. So actually there are great rishis who can... they can access the Vedas. The Vedas exist eternally, and they are able to access those. So this is transcendental knowledge. We have to recognize it as such. That's part of our humility. That's the challenge. Why we try to give people books, because we want people to see, look, this is not something ordinary. This is something extraordinary here. I just wrote an editorial. I think I may have mentioned this in class, that when I was reading recently, a while back, the story of Lord Brahma. So when he heard this sound, tapa, what was he doing? He was bewildered. He was trying to figure out, who am I? What am I supposed to do? So he was just kind of speculating, trying to think, what's going on? Who am I? Where do I come from? What's it all about? Just like we ask, if we're intelligent. So he was thinking like that. So first he was just speculating in his mind. And then he decided to do some research. So he conducted research, climbed down into the lotus, but he climbed down and down and down and down and down, and he kept on going and going, and he didn't come to the end, and finally said, I give up. So he went all the way back to the top, and then he heard tapa, tapa. He heard this sound twice. So he knew somehow, innately, intuitively, that this is a transcendental sound vibration. This is aparusheya. This is coming from beyond, not from this arena that I'm in. It's coming from beyond this sound, and it's telling me that I should perform austere meditation. Then I'll understand the answer. So he recognized It just was transcendental sound coming from another world. So the Vedas are transcendental sound coming from another world, but people don't recognize it. They want to challenge it. They don't have enough humility or enough experience or enough access. So we're trying to make the Vedas accessible, let people see. Look, read this. Sometimes we hear, of course, we have so many fantastic things in our books. So sometimes people, they just hear something and they just say, oh, they just want to dismiss the whole thing. We'll have people, you know, flying around or whatever, or God coming as an animal, or something they hear, they say, well, this is all, what? You expect me to believe this? You take this seriously? Really? But when you study them, then you'll see, wow, this is substantial. When you read the Bhagavatam, then you see, this is not written by ignorant people. This is not just folk tales. This is substantial knowledge. Vejam vastravam atravastu. The second verse of the Bhagavatam says, the Bhagavatam is presenting substance, something that's real. So if you associate with that, then you become convinced. Sometimes even in our own words, it's hard for us to maybe tell people why we believe these books. It's like so many, now today, of course, so many people will reject the Bible. Oh, that's just, that's not the truth. You think it's the Word of God, but I don't think it's the Word of God. So it may be difficult for us to explain our conviction for the Vedas, because part of that conviction is just they've touched us in some way. The Bhagavatam has touched us. It has, when we look at that picture that's presented there and how it's all put together and the majesty of it, then, getting that access to it and touching it and being in that, in the environment of it, placing ourselves in it, that we feel it intuitively. There's an intuitive conviction that we get. We might not be able to explain step by step in a perfectly rational way that everyone is going to accept. Of course, that's life anyway. People have so many beliefs. They can't explain why they believe certain things. People believe all kinds of crazy things. In fact, sometimes they do these what do you call them? When you do research and you ask people, opinion polls. So they'll ask people opinions and they'll ask them one question, one part of the questionnaire, and then another question in the other part of the questionnaire, and they'll answer the two questions in a way that are completely contradictory. They completely contradict them. The people hold completely contradictory beliefs. And if you point it out to them, then they say, oh, yeah, I guess you're right. But somehow still I believe this and that, both of these things at the same time. So we have beliefs, but they're not, we don't know where they're coming from. So we're out there to challenge people's beliefs, to show people that the how they're in illusion, actually. Just like one, this may not be one that we want to lead with necessarily, but the idea of attraction to the opposite sex, when you think about what it is, being attracted to, as we say, a bag of stool, use the old brahmachari class phrase. So, but that's what it is. It's blood and guts and hair, but we're attracted to it just because of the way it's packaged. So is this rational? It's an illusion. You have to admit it's an illusion to be attracted to a bag of those things. Skin. If I give you some skin here, you want some skin? No. But when it's on a, wrapped up in a certain way, and we think, oh, how beautiful. People will kill for that. But it's an illusion, obviously. So, part of what we do, we try to show people that, no, there are so many illusions that we live under. So don't think you know everything, in other words. Don't think that everything you do is completely rational, because people want to think like that. You talk to them, and they think they're great philosophers all of a sudden. As soon as they start talking with a devotee, it's like all they do all day long is think philosophy, which they never do think any philosophy, only what they hear on some sitcom or something. That's their philosophy. So, but we have some real philosophy. And so we want to there's one thing we want to transmit to people, is there's substance here. There's transcendental sound. So be a little humble. That's the point. You have to become a little bit humble. That's really the first step in taking the spiritual life. Ado shraddha tatu sadhu sangha. So to get that shraddha, initial faith, then you have to believe, or you have to give up the other shraddha, that I know everything. Or maybe that human society knows everything, or the scientists know everything. And you have to think, well, maybe we don't have all the answers. Prabhupada would hammer on this so much, wouldn't he? They think they know everything, but look at the mess they're making of things. They don't know anything. They're just bluffing. That's what they're doing. Like he said in his purport, they're always in trouble. The scientists are in just as much trouble as we are, especially when it gets down to philosophy. Of course, mostly scientists, they're not philosophers either. They're doing their little thing in the lab, whatever it is, their little job they're doing. They're not looking at the big picture. There are a few philosophical scientists, but most of them are technicians. I mean, that's what it is. You have a car mechanic is fixing one thing, and you have a scientist with a PhD is fixing something else. But they're making a mess of it. Even those who are doing the thinking, they're rejecting. What I just came across recently, this may have been said by a scientist half seriously, because when they, of course, today, the idea of where did everything come from, that's the big question. So they come back to the Big Bang. I don't know if they really use that term anymore, but they talk about the singularity, that everything started from a point of infinitesimal size and infinite mass, or infinite density, something like that. So somebody scoffing at that idea said, yes, give me one miracle and then I can explain everything else. So this is really, they're invoking a miracle. And that's what they're doing. They scoff at religious people for talking about miracles. But what is that, a singularity? Because that's what they do, of course, in science. They're gyanis, so they challenge each other. So there's not like everybody is sold on this idea. They have to come up with new ideas all the time because this one doesn't necessarily work. And just especially because of this, well, where did that come from? Why is that there? That's the big question, why? Why is that there? So don't think you know everything. You have to get rid of this pride in your own power, in your own thinking ability. Our brains are so tiny. So that's one thing also we see in the Bhagavatam, the great philosophy. Now that I'm working on the Bhagavat Sandarbha, so I'm seeing, boy, phew, Jiva Goswami, he really had a brain. One thing about Jiva Goswami was when he went, of course, he went to Mayapur, and Nityananda Prabhu gave him the tour of Navadvipa Dham. And then he went and studied in Varanasi, which is places full of Mayavadis, of course, but he went there to study Nyaya and all the different philosophies, Mimamsa, Karma Mimamsa, and all these things. He studied from a Vaishnava teacher, but he studied all of these things, and they're very, very complex and intricate, all these different Vedangas, different aspects of the Vedas. So he mastered all of these things, besides, of course, mastering the teachings of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So he wasn't some ordinary person. He was a great intellect, spiritually surcharged intellect. So he's explaining so wonderfully. In the Tapasandarbha, the first book of the Shatsandarbha, by the way, maybe I should just give I know devotees, they kind of know that the Jiva Goswami wrote the Sandarbhas, but maybe they're not quite sure what they are. But they're called the Shatsandarbha because there are six of them. And they're also called the Bhagavat Sandarbha because they're about the Bhagavatam. They're actually a commentary on the Bhagavatam, but they're not a verse-by-verse commentary. Now, Jiva did write a verse-by-verse commentary called Krama Sandarbha, which Prabhupada actually uses a lot, although he doesn't necessarily mention Jiva's name a lot. He gets a lot of his points from the Krama Sandarbha. So these six Sandarbhas, the first one is the Sat Sandarbha, and the second one is the Bhagavat Sandarbha. So there's Bhagavat Sandarbha, that's all six of them, and one of those six is called the Bhagavat Sandarbha. So Bhagavat means about Bhagavan. So in the Bhagavat Sandarbha, Jiva Goswami is establishing the supremacy of Bhagavan. He begins by quoting Badantita Tattva Vidas Tattvam Yajjnanam Advayam Brahmaiti Paramatmaiti Bhagavan Iti Shabdiyade. So there are three phases of the Absolute Truth. So his whole argument, or at least the first part of the Bhagavat Sandarbha, is to establish that Bhagavan is the supreme of these three aspects of the Absolute Truth. So he, in the Tattva Sandarbha, as I started to say, he establishes his primary pramana. Pramana means the basis of his evidence, how he's going to prove it. Because people want things to be proven. Prove it to me. So he shows that the best proof is Shabda, as I was saying earlier, the Vedas. So he discusses this point, how the Vedas are eternal transcendental knowledge. And then he goes to great lengths to explain how the Puranas are the fifth Veda. So you shouldn't put them in a lower category. The Vedas are actually just as important. In fact, for us now, the Puranas are more important than the original Vedas. In fact, the word Purana means to complete. Purana, which means to complete. So they complete the Vedas, and you won't get a complete understanding of the Vedas. In fact, you won't understand them at all these days. You have to know so many things. Unless you read the Puranas. And of all the Puranas, the highest one, the Amala Purana, is Srimad Bhagavatam. So then basically he says that now I'm going to prove everything I say by quoting the Bhagavatam. But he doesn't just do that. I'm finding that out in the Bhagavat Purana, Bhagavat Sandarbha, that whenever he quotes anything from the Bhagavatam to establish his point, then he quotes this Veda and that Veda and this Upanishad and that Upanishad. He doesn't just quote the Bhagavatam. He substantiates everything in the Bhagavatam by quoting the Vedas. Even in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna also, when he speaks, of course he's God himself, he doesn't have to quote another authority, but he quotes the Vedas. He's showing how authoritative they are. Kapila Dev does the same thing when he starts talking to his mother. Now I'm going to quote from authority. So to establish the authority of the Vedas is so important. So we have to, of course we repeat this over and over again, how important it is to study Srila Prabhupada's books, because otherwise you don't get an appreciation for them. You may think other people have good ideas, but they're just babbling. They don't know what they're saying. They're like frogs croaking, no benefit. We may be impressed because people have big credentials. This PhD, so many, sometimes they have, so many. Besides, they earn a few PhDs and then they get honorary ones too and they pile them up. So then people think, oh, you get so intimidated. You see that whole list. In India, they like to line them all up, all these letters after their names. I don't even know what they mean. They'd like to show those. So, and we may also feel, you get intimidated. So, of course, maybe we are. We can't compete with them and the things that they know. But we know more because we know the Bhagavatam. Vidya Bhagavata Abadi. The Bhagavatam is the end of knowledge. It gives everything. Because you know the progression. The essence, the philosophical essence of the Vedas are the Upanishads. And the explanation of the Upanishads is Vedanta Sutra. Vyasadeva, who wrote he compiled the Upanishads, compiled the Vedic literature, categorized it, and then he explained it in Vedanta Sutra. And Srimad Bhagavatam is the natural commentary, as Prabhupada said. It's Vyasadeva, again, explaining the Vedanta Sutra. So, the Bhagavatam is everything. It's Brahma Sammitam. It's Brahman. Brahma means the Vedic literature. But Brahma also means God, Brahman. They mean the same thing because they are. They're identical. Vedic knowledge is identical with Krishna. So we have to study these books to get an appreciation and get some conviction. I don't have to hear from these croaking frogs. I was just hearing a lecture. Prabhupada was imitating them. Of course, there's this verse in the second canto. It says that those who hear, they have ears like the ears of ear holes, or like the holes of snakes. Those who hear other than Krishna Gita, their ears are like snake holes. Not the ears on the snakes, but the holes the snakes go in, and their tongues that don't chant Krishna Gita are like the croaking of frogs. And Prabhupada has a nice way he does it. Kakaraka, kakaraka. I learned how he said. I was listening to it. Kakaraka, kakaraka. So this is what the frogs do. Kakaraka, kakaraka. So they're doing that, and what are they doing? They're just calling. They're saying to the snake, "Here I am. Come and get me." So sometimes death is called a snake too, isn't it? Kala, Kala Sarpa, the snake of time or the snake of death. So they're saying so many things. They think they have so many intelligent things to say, but they're just kakaraka. They're calling death. "Here I am. Come and get me. I'm so proud. I challenge you." But what can they do? Krishna's just one little slap. Just like Lord Boar, he was fighting with Hiranyaksha, so powerful. The Garbhodaka ocean was up to his knees. We have that picture in the Bhagavatam. So just a little slap. So what to kill a big demon like you with all your PhDs? Nothing. So we shouldn't be impressed. We should be impressed by Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita. Give up that pride. So it's so important. This is just one aspect of pride. We have so many things ourselves. We have so many things that we could become proud so easily. So that's a real challenge we have to get rid of this, because it's a great obstacle to spiritual life. So we have to work on it. And this is our solution, as it's a solution for everything, hearing and chanting. There's power in that to remove this obstacle to our spiritual life. All right. I seem to be getting long-winded in my old age here. I used to give shorter classes, I think. Anyway, we'll stop here. I'll just read the first verse. Again, Balaram addressed Krishna. "Blinded by conceit with their personal opulences, proud men offend others for the sake of such things as kingdom, land, wealth, women, honor, and power." Any questions or comments? Yes. Hariparayana Prabhu.
So, Prabhuji, I was just at a conference, a scientific conference, and, you know, there are people talking about evolutionary biology, some people talking about physics, mm-hmm. Big Bang. I was just walking up to the temple just now before your class, and I was thinking, well, how can I explain to people the kinds of things I believe in?
Mm-hmm.
And then you addressed the same topic, so thank you. But one thing that I found is telling people that Shabda Praman is higher is not convincing, to tell them that there is knowledge beyond. They say, well, there are so many different kinds. The Christians say the same thing.
Yeah.
So the one thing that seems to work, at least for me, is that I say, do you believe that you exist?
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're just atoms, then that means you're no different than the dirt on the street. So if you're just dirt, then who is perceiving and who is being perceived? What is knowledge? What does it mean? The words I'm saying are just energy and vapor in air. It doesn't mean, nothing means anything. If there is no existence of the soul, then there is no existence of anything, because atoms cannot perceive each other. So really it comes down to a choice. At least that's how I present it. Is you either accept that you don't exist, which is an absurd thing to do,
mm-hmm.
You're just a robot that has a circuit in your brain. Robots don't have emotions, they don't have feelings. So you're a more sophisticated robot, but then, okay, what does it mean to, what does truth mean? What do these words mean? Or you have to make the choice that you exist. And then the only philosophy in the world today that gives you that choice is the Bhagavatam and the Bhagavad Gita. Mm-hmm. So I think that seems to work.
Yeah, that's very good. And Sariputta Prabhu would also always hammer on this point, consciousness. Or we can explain it simply that, you know, there's a subject and the object. We are experiencing subjects, we ourselves, and there's the objective world. So do you admit that, you know, as you're saying, you're an experiencer? Who is that experiencer? Where does that experiencer come from? So we say, of course, there are those who say, well, that's dualism. I don't believe in dualism. Yeah. They're monists, yeah. They're spiritual monists, and they're materialist monists. So the hardcore scientists who believe in scientism, you can say, there's only matter. So that's a kind of monism, too. It's called that, actually. There's only atoms or material energy. But, of course, we can give different arguments about, no, there is, just like you're saying, they still hold out for the idea, the hope, that, well, we will be able to make conscious robots. They still think in principle, at least there are those who do, who create conscious, because they, one thing is they can't agree on what consciousness is. I read a book recently, it was written by someone who's a Buddhist, actually. It was called Consciousness Something, I forget, it had a subtitle. But his whole thing was that consciousness is being itself. Like you say, I exist. But actually, when I was reading this book, I was saying, is that our philosophy exactly? Is that what we say? That I am, is that's it? Or do we say that consciousness, or is it that we are some, we're made of something, we are something, a particle of something that has consciousness? So I just came across, actually, somebody was summarizing one of the Sandarbhas. It was an old BTG article. And he was explaining there, Jiva Goswami says, it's this side. No, we are a particle of Satchidananda, and our characteristic is consciousness. So it's kind of subtle. This idea that just being itself is what we are, you can say, that's actually a Buddhist or an impersonalistic idea. It becomes a little dangerous. There are certain implications there that can lead one into impersonalism. So we are actually conscious entities. We are entities who have consciousness. Of course, the spirit, the owner, the quality and the owner of the quality spiritually are one, but there's also the difference there. So again, Achintya Bheda Abheda Tattva enters into the discussion. So who has these kinds of discussions? Who, what book, as you're saying, you're not going to find this in the Bible, obviously. And of course, all the metaphysics in Christianity and Judaism, it comes mostly from the Greeks. That's because it's not there in the Bible. Jesus didn't teach it. And the old prophets of the Old Testament, they didn't teach these things. They taught more moral principles and character and, you know, devotion to God, or at least surrender, submission to God. So that's there. In one sense, they taught the highest thing, surrender to God. But in trying to explain spirit and that whole side of things, they had to borrow from others. But we have it right there, our acharyas. So there's a lot of, like when you first started talking about people won't accept Shabda, one reason they don't accept is because they're not exposed to it. I remember one time, I heard this years ago, the person was a scientist, I don't know what his field was, maybe it was biology, I don't remember, but he read our explanation of the creation, and he believed in evolution, this person. But he said, well, I don't believe this, but one thing I can say is that it holds together, that it makes sense, you know. There are different ways to explain things, and this is a, you might say, reasonable explanation. You know? You can follow it step by step. So if you're intelligent, you can apply your intelligence to the Bhagavatam, and you'll be satisfied. But, of course, you have to do the research. You have to make the exercise and do it. Pranga Vinipu?
San Francisco, yeah. But his, I was reading many years back with Sadhavadabhu, actually, his, how from deep, dark, atheistic idea came to theistic. And the preacher who challenged him, he said, what is your problem? The whole thesis on Jesus' teaching. He said, well, I don't believe anything. I have a doubt. He said, so what is your conclusion? He says, well, I think as soon as you die, nothing exists. He said, good. Then give me an answer. Who is the doubter here? Mm-hmm. If you believe that you are composed of atoms, who is the doubter? If doubt cannot have existence without a doubter. So then Charles Berkeley, he was kind of a pause for a while, and he said, therefore, I exist. I cannot say Adam can have a doubt. So he transformed and he became theist, and then he wrote a whole book about it.
Yeah.
I was saying one thing that interesting. Srila Prabhupada, in one lecture, he says, our goal is to become a family member of Krishna's. Mm-hmm. Now I'm thinking, this is a, you know, there's a famous verse that garba, the pride, another name of pride is garba. Garba vilasurudita harsha soka bhaya moha. There's a 33 sanchari bhav in Nectar of Devotion, Rupa Goswami Pada explained. And one of the explanation Prabhupada translated of Rupa Goswami is that boy approached to Lord Krishna in Dwarka, say, "My Lord, I don't know, I did not do anything, no austerity, no study, no penance, nothing. Only thing I had is a little affection for this famous queen, Rukmini, and as a result, her father sent me with her, 300 maid servant." This is Prabhupada wrote in Nectar Devotion, you can see. So I'm thinking like this, that the goal, Prabhupada said, to be a member of Krishna's family. But Rukmi, he actually had a chance, but some or other he missed it. But the other boy, who is not born in the family, but he came as a Rukmini's brother. In Vedic culture, like if the boy's neighbor, they like this girl, protecting her. When she gets married, he also gets as a dowry. So that's how he came to Dwarka. And he got the chance. The reason I'm saying it, because Prabhupada in third canto, second chapter, he also says, all these demons, the Uddhava is lamenting, I did not go, I could not be delivered, Lord left, all the demon gods see it. So one of the purpose Prabhupada writes very nicely, that when the demon dies, how to see? So there is a three perception. One, that as soon as Sudarshan Chakra dissolved their subtle body, if they see the form of the Lord, then if they criticize, like Shishupal Prabhupada gave, then he will march. If they appreciate, then they will go to Vaikuntha. And if they glorify, then they will go to Goloka. It was very nice. But some other, I feel very bad for Rukmini's position. He's so close, yet so far.
I realized the other day why they're called monists, because all they can do is moan about the material nature. They have no positive spiritual knowledge to talk about. Yeah. And you were saying how this literature is not composed by foolish human beings, it's not faulty. And I read the other day that Ralph Waldo Emerson said the Srimad Bhagavatam is a book that should be read on one's knees. Mm-hmm.
All right, we'll stop here. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.